I looked on the web for this series and was slightly disappointed finding that all the string theory talks were actually Blackboard talks, and most of the condensed matter talks, if not all, were actually transparency based. So my talk will have no transparency at all whatsoever. Perhaps that's not advisable because I'll have some experimental results which I will just sketch. And what I wanted to tell you today about are the class of systems in which quantum Hall phenomena and other phenomena that our program is involved with are seen, and why this class of systems is very special, and why is it that this class of systems keeps on producing surprises and also very good experimental and theoretical physics. And to give you an idea, let me just give you an arbitrary list of topics or phenomena which have either been discovered or predicted, and sometimes both together also, in this class of systems. And then I'll explain to you why this class of systems, which is on the surface quite simple, so rich. So of course you all know about quantum Hall effect and fractional quantum Hall effect. Well, you at least have heard of it, what they are. And these two are perhaps the most important in some sense, certainly the most famous discoveries in this subject. And they were both observed, not predicted. So I'm going to put notations next to it to let you know which ones were observed, which ones are predicted but not observed, and if both happened, then I'm going to put both. There is no ranking in the order. I'm just giving an arbitrary ranking. Superconductivity has certainly been predicted in these systems. I said they have not been observed yet. Josephson effect without superconductivity has been predicted in this system. Okay, there is a Josephson effect associated with superconductivity, which of course you will have if you have superconductivity, but I'm talking about Josephson effect without superconductivity. That has been predicted. Weak and strong localization. Anderson localization, both predicted and observed. Two-dimensional metal, I'm calling it metal because really in two dimensions there are no metals. Two-dimensional metal unstable transitions are observed. It's a big topic of our program and was a big topic in our conference also. Linearly dispersing collective modes both predicted and observed. But these linearly dispersive collective modes that I'm talking about are not necessarily Goldstone modes. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, many Goldstone modes have been predicted in these systems because there are many predicted spontaneous breaking of symmetries, and I'll talk about some of them today. As far as I know, no Goldstone mode directly has been observed in these systems. I asked a few people, I certainly couldn't find any predicted. It's not clear to me that it has been observed, even this likely to be observed. Let's see. On more solid state type aspect, things that have been predicted, in fact this was one of the original motivation of introducing this system, block oscillation, and the idea is that if you have a super lattice of two-dimensional electron systems, then the electrons form a one-dimensional band, and then the electrons could then oscillate. It could go to the end of the Brillouin zone and come back. And in fact, this oscillation was the original motivation for Liu-Esaki to propose these super lattice systems. But they're very hard to see because you have scattering, and as far as I know, they have not really been seen. Well, in the frequency domain, I'm talking about real block oscillation. Okay, I'll distinguish the two, being a purist. Okay, so that was the next thing. So frequency domain, so this is really for experts, so I'm calling them various kind of Stark effects. And I agree that if you see this, that implies that. But direct transport block oscillations have not been seen, and you know that would be nice to see. Okay. Observed. Let me see, I had a list of things because this list was very odd. Then Coulomb blockade. Is actually originally observed, but then the prediction should have come, but for some reason it wasn't predicted. Conductance quantization, it was observed and certainly claimed by at least three different individuals, but perhaps more that they predicted it, because I wrote a paper on this after the observation where I said it was not predicted, and I got polite to angry letters from people that claiming they predicted it, but I would really say it wasn't predicted, because none of them actually, their papers implied it, but they didn't say it would be there. They were hedging. And in fact, that brings a historical note. You know that it could be claimed that quantum Hall effect was predicted. Sunny Ando had a paper in 1975. In fact, it was part of his thesis. If you go read that paper, there is a clear statement there. A sentence says, this means that disorder will not affect Hall resistance, and Hall resistance will have exactly the value, you know, that we now call quantum Hall resistance. If he just stopped there, I would have given him credit, and most of the community would have given him credit for predicting it, even though using somewhat wrong or quite wrong reasons, but that's okay, you know, the truth is what matters. But then in the next sentence he says, of course this theoretical prediction cannot be true because of disorder. Disorder will change this from this value to something else, okay? So, okay, conductance quantization. Let's see what else I have here. Do not want to forget anybody's favorite subject, Wigner crystallization, which is some of these things I'll actually discuss in greater detail later. Predicted, and probably aspects of it have been seen. It's not Wigner crystallization in nothing but the fact that this is something predicted by Eugene Wigner in 1932 or 35. And the fact is that if you make the potential energy much, much stronger than kinetic energy in a quantum system, the system will want to minimize potential energy, and we all know that the minimum of a potential energy is not a liquid, but a crystalline state, so the system will crystallize. And it actually has been seen on surface of liquid helium, a classical Wigner crystal. Quantum Wigner crystal will be where the system is quantum, and it's a difficult thing to see. We may have one of these directors' lunch talk later on this. It's a difficult thing to see because if you have a crystal, the crystal will be pinned by impurities in the system, and then it's not really clear how you distinguish a crystal from a glass or from a very strongly interacting liquid with lots of impurities. It's not absolutely clear. You cannot really do a scattering experiment, diffraction experiment to see it. Ferromagnetism, quantum ferromagnetism. I would say both predicted and observed, no question about it. Quantum antiferromagnetism, including Cantor antiferromagnetism, certainly predicted. Well, I'll not put anything since I did the prediction. I think it's observed also by Pingzuk. We had a talk on that in our conference. And skarmions, this is one of the great triumphs of theory. It was predicted and I would say certainly observed, even though not all the numbers check out completely. And finally, I'll just put down one, and this is not an exhaustive list by any means. I'm just giving you an idea of various things. Lattringer liquids. And Lattringer liquids are one-dimensional electron systems, which in principle do not have a Fermi surface at zero temperature. And if you have a one-dimensional electron gas, which is part of our program certainly, then that should be intrinsically Lattringer liquid. Also, the edges of quantum Hall liquid should be Lattringer liquids, and there are lots of papers on it. I'd say predicted, and I would put observed, because some of the most famous experiments in the recent past seem to validate the theory, but very recent experiments have brought up very important questions on whether what is observed really is a pristine Lattringer liquid-like behavior or something else. And again, we could have a director's lunch talk just on this topic later on. These topics are somewhat more technical. Anyway, this is just an arbitrary compendium of video. Kondo effect. That's another thing. And we'll have a seminar on this, experimental seminar on this, I believe in October. It was predicted by Patrick Lee and his collaborators and observed recently in quantum dot. So if you just look at it and you know something about condensed matter physics, you see many of your favorite words, phenomena showing up here, all in the same class of systems. And why? Why is it that all these interesting effects show up in one class of systems? Usually in condensed matter physics, to see different phenomena, you have to go to different systems. And except for superconductivity, all the other things we talk about show up here. And well, you know, the why, this kind of why, of course, the answer is always somewhat subjective and somewhat fluffy. I would say it's because in these systems, one has a precisely known microscopic Hamiltonian whose parameters are completely tunable. Okay? So I would say that the Hamiltonian for these systems, and I have not told you what these systems are, but I'll tell you what the systems are in a minute. So it's a, so you have electronic Hamiltonian, electron kinetic energy, you have electron-electron interaction, electron-impedance interaction, you have some part of the one particle Hamiltonian that produces confinement to give you two-dimensional or lower dimensional systems, and then in principle you have H electron phonon. I'll write some of those things down later on. Right now, all I want to mention is that all of these things are precisely known, and all of these things, except perhaps with the exception of perhaps electron phonon part, but some people claim even that is completely tunable. These certainly are completely tunable, meaning you have a parameter which is under experimental control, essentially electric field, and just by changing the electric field, you can change these two at will within, when I say at will, within two orders of magnitude, maybe even 2.5 orders of magnitude, okay? And electron impurity, which usually is a bad thing for condensed matter physics, you do not want a lot of disorder, that can be really minimized. The best two-dimensional systems that I will talk about later are in fact comparable to the very best metals if you look at their low temperature mean free path. I mean, I on the weekend I was trying to find what is the ultra pure copper, let's say, what is the longest mean free path anybody has measured, and it's a fraction of a centimeter. And in these systems we also have mean free path for this 20 million mobility, which is of the order of a millimeter. So in these semiconductor systems, you have mean free path which is comparable to ultra-pure copper. You may not be impressed until you realize that in semiconductor you do not have electrons. To get electrons, you have to put impurities. That's the only way you get electrons in semiconductors. Since you have overall charge neutrality, for every free electron that you put in, semiconductors are just insulators. So every free electron that you get in a semiconductor, you must have a charge impurity somewhere. So if you take ordinary transistors, their mean free path is very short because of that, because they are all the time scattering from the impurities that produce them. But in this system, that doesn't happen. So this precisely tunable Hamiltonian describing low dimensional electron system is one clue. So if you can tune the parameters, of course you can see various phenomena. So one is the tunable, so you can change the strength of the interaction. You can go from a truly weak coupling perturbative system, like a very high density electron system, to a very strong coupling non-perturbative system and a very low density electron system just by changing an electric field. And then you have low dimensional, the systems are confined, and I'll come to that. And number two is that disorder can be made very weak so mean free path larger than hydromicrometers, I should say, low temperature. Well, that's obvious, you cannot, phonons you cannot do much. And three, and this is also important, lattice and band effects are negligible. What I mean by that, usually when you look at solid state phenomena, look at a solid state physics textbook, things don't look very universal. You know, you go from one material to another, bands change, effect of lattice changes, and if you're a pure theorist, it's a lot of work to kind of do away with all those things which are always there. The thing comes with that baggage. Suppose you want to measure electron-electron interaction effect in three-dimensional systems. Well, you have to go from one metal to another. And when you go from one metal to another, you change electron interaction, but you also change the background lattice effect. And there is no unique way to disentangle the two. I mean, you just have to do some theory and hope your theory is right. In these systems, it turns out that electrons, at least in gallium arsenide system, really obeys theory's dream of a parabolic dispersion, non-isotropic, just an electron with the non-interacting electron really behaves like has a dispersion of h bar squared k squared over 2m to a high degree of accuracy, two-dimensional dispersion. So that again allows theory and experiment to make contact, even quantitative contact, reasonably easily. So let me just tell you now what I mean by these continuously tunable parameters. I want to write down some numbers to show you, because remember, these effects take place simply because the numbers work out correctly. I mean, there is no way you can write down your favorite Lagrangian, but the parameters on that Lagrangian are actually controlled by these. Okay? So whether you see a particular effect or not depends on whether the parameters in that Lagrangian are in the relevant part of your phase diagram. It's very important to realize that. And if you take a thin metal film, that will also be two-dimensional, but you are not going to see quantum Hall effect or fractional quantum Hall effect or many of these other things we are talking about, because even though the Lagrangian presumably will be the same, the reason is the parameters will be such that you will never be near the interesting regime. So I'm going to write down some of the parameters. In fact, I calculated some of them. Maybe I will not find it before coming here. So let me just give you some broad idea. Let's say Fermi temperature. So Fermi temperature is the degeneracy temperature of a Fermi system. This is just the Fermi energy divided by KB. So in the systems we are talking about, so I'll just call them generically two-dimensional electron gases. Okay, and just to give you an idea, metals, which are three-dimensional electron gases. So Fermi temperature in this system, since you can tune densities, range from 1 to 10 square Kelvin. Okay. Well, in metals, you all know, this is 10 to the power 4 Kelvin, and it's not tunable. You know, metal density changes only by a factor of 2, so it changes. So immediately you can see that here you have a good chance, and in fact here, classical quantum crossover phenomena can be studied. In metals, you're always in a deep quantum regime because, you know, most metals will meet. I mean, you can't really do experiments much above 500 Kelvin. Okay. Then let's say Coulomb temperature. So Coulomb temperature is slightly ill-defined. It's the temperature scale of the electron-electron interaction. There is no unique way of defining it, but I'll define it as E squared divided by the average separation between the electrons, which is a reasonable way of defining it. And that here also changes from 1 to 10 square Kelvin, depending on density and so on. The power law dependence on densities in these two things are different, so don't be misled by that. I'll come to that. And here it's more like 2.5 times 10 to the power 4 Kelvin. You cannot really change this. It's, you know, metal, this is of the order of, this ratio is of the order of 3 to 5 in metals. Okay, it's fixed. And again, there is no way you can do anything to change it. You can apply pressure, make 10% changes and so on, but nothing larger than that. Disorder, there is a precise way of measuring the disorder energy scale also. I don't want to get into it, but it's very well defined. And that, of course, is comparable in the two, because you can make metals ultra pure. Okay, one would even say that they're metals probably could be slightly purer than this system. So that number could be 10 to the power minus 2 to as bad as you want. You know, making it very bad is not a problem. So you can, I mean, upper limit doesn't have any meaning. You can always make anything very, very...
Can I just yeah. show you I'm coming from another world?
Please.
Is that T Coulomb at that temperature? Thermal
energy? No. It's just T Coulomb is nothing but E square divided by the average separation of electron is equal to KBTD. So this is... Okay, this is, yeah. Yeah, this is the energy scale of the electron-electron interaction. Okay, energy scale of... So metals are very strongly interacting system.
So when we talk about our system, we are on one, which is that distance...
That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. Yes. That's the same scale. Yes. And in your case, it's usually always like room temperature, right? A little bit lower than that in biological systems. Right. No, but in biological systems, typically, the interaction scale, my understanding is room temperature are somewhat below that, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Usually a factor of dielectric constant.
Right. I mean, yeah. No, but that dielectric constant is built in here. So if you want that to be precise, it's this. Okay. This is what it is. And then omega plasmon, or H bar omega plasmon. So this is the energy scale of the collective mode in these systems, okay? Well, for metals, everything is one electron volt, you know. That's exactly what you expect. Metals are formed by atoms. Atoms get together. Its atomic energy scale decides everything. There's nothing more there. So metals, this is 10 to the power 4 Kelvin. Plasmons are very high energy excitations. And that's why, you know, collective modes in metals really have nothing to do with any of the low energy phenomena like superconductivity and so on. Here, on the other hand, the plasmon actually goes to zero order Q. So it could be any energy. It goes to zero as Q half for two dimension, and I'll write down later for one dimension and so on. Okay, so you can say that typical energy scale for plasmon here could be zero. And finally, And the last two quantities are the if you apply magnetic field, what happens? Because magnetic field, again, is not a particularly interesting tool in metals. I mean, in metals, magnetic field is used only to study the Fermi surface. There are some new phenomena that you have because of magnetic field, but they are not astounding. All of them you can understand on the basis of zero magnetic field theory. Just put in magnetic field, for example, de Haas van Alphen effect, which arises just from the modulation of density of states and so on. But here, of course, magnetic field introduces energy scale, which is h bar omega c. This is just the Larmor frequency or cyclotron frequency. This is of the order of, again, you can make it as small as you want. That's not the point. But it could be made as large as, let's say, 5 times 500 Kelvin. Okay, you can make it as small. When magnetic field is zero, it's of course zero. Metal, that number is very small because metals are very large mass. So in metal, this number is more like of the order of 1 Kelvin. Okay. And finally, spin splitting in a magnetic field. So spin splitting in a magnetic field is of the order of 1 to 10 Kelvin here, and it's also of the order of 1 to 10 Kelvin here. Magnetic fields in these two may not be exactly the same. So you start just by looking at this table, which is really a very rudimentary table. You should immediately get an appreciation for why these systems are very interesting. First, you notice that the magnetic field orbital quantization energy can be made much, much larger than Fermi energy or comparable. That means magnetic field will have non-trivial, non-perturbative effect. That was realized before quantum Hall and fractional quantum Hall were discovered. It's not like people didn't realize that. That's why von Klitzing was studying high field magnetotransport. But what those new phenomena are, people didn't know. And quantum Hall and fractional quantum Hall are, people thought that what you basically get when you make magnetic field very high is that you get a Wigner crystal. And what we now know, long before Wigner crystal comes, there is a whole host of very interesting phenomena. And again, this energy scale and the fact that things can be tuned to energy scale is what makes that possible. And I think there is no disagreement on that. Since I derived some little formula for how these things vary in these systems, I'm going to write them down. So h bar omega c is roughly 20 times b in Tesla Kelvin. This is all for gallium arsenide two-dimensional systems. Most of our program really is on gallium arsenide two-dimensional systems, even though there are a few other systems. There is some on silicon, but mostly on that. EF, so B is the magnetic field in Tesla. EF is 40 times NS, where NS is measured in 10 to the power 11 per square centimeter in Kelvin. So NS is the electron density in our system per square centimeter. So this number for three-dimensional system will be, you know, three-dimensional free electron density of the order of 10 to the power 23 per cubic centimeter. So you can see the number here is very low because the typical thickness of our layers is about 100 angstrom. So if you convert that into a three-dimensional density, this is about 10 to the power 17 or 10 to the power 18. So it's 5 to 7 orders of magnitude lower than the corresponding absolute density in a three-dimensional system. Now, why am I mentioning that? That's what makes experiments very difficult here. If you want to do transport measurement, it's fine, because transport, these are the only electrons carrying current. But if you want to do thermodynamic measurements, then you have to realize that you're trying to measure a 10 to the power minus 6 effect just off the bat. Why? Because you cannot eliminate the background. You know, you make a two-dimensional electron gas on something, but you always have underlying substrate, which has 10 to the power 22 electrons per cubic centimeter, and here you have only 10 to the power 17, 10 to the power 18, maybe at most 10 to the power 19 electrons per cubic centimeter. So thermodynamic measurements, it's very easy for theorists to say, well, there is a phase transition, why don't you look at specific heat, you know, superfluid, condensed and discontinuous, and so on. And the invariable answer of experimentalists is very hard to do that. The reason is this, that they will have to look for a one part in 10 to the power 6 effect, okay? Because let me just remind you, this converts very roughly of the order of 10 to the power 17 per cubic centimeter in three-dimensional units, okay? And other formula I wrote down is for the Larmor radius, and that is 250 times B in Tesla in angstroms. And I can write down KF inverse for you also, just to, this is the cyclotron radius, LC, not mean free path. KF inverse is roughly 126 times this NS 10 to the power 11 angstrom. So again, when you look at this thing, you immediately realize that this number in three-dimensional metals, you all know what this number is, right? Of the order of 1 angstrom. This number is of the order of 1 angstrom in three-dimensional metals. Doesn't change much with density because all the densities are the same. And so you can make this number much, much larger. This number in metals is much larger because the mass is much larger and so on. Well, this number in metals is the same because Larmor radius doesn't, I mean this number is much smaller, okay, in metals because the mass is. So what makes all of this possible? Why is it that in this system energy scales and the length scales change? And this was alluded to already, so let's look at, I mentioned that after all the metallic energy scales are set by atomic physics, electron volts. Well, you would have thought that these are after all made of atoms, so the energy scale here should be electron volts also, but that's not the case, because here what you have is a few electrons moving in an effective mass approximation. So I'll first write down the energy scale and then I'll tell you what the systems are like. So let me write down the energy scale first before I tell you what the systems are like. So the effective Rydberg in these systems, okay, effective Rydberg is E square over 2 effective Bohr radius. That formula doesn't change. Okay. Now what is Bohr, let's see, I think there's a kappa in the definition of Rydberg. No, I'll just put it in the definition. What is Bohr radius? Bohr radius is kappa H bar square divided by m E square. So this m is effective mass and this is the effective dielectric constant. This gives you the factor of 1,000 that I'm talking about. Okay? In these systems, the effective dielectric constant of gallium arsenide, or for that matter any of the other semiconductors you work with, and gallium arsenide, I think it happens to be around 13, it's always of the order of 10, that's the point. Okay? So you get a factor of 10 from here, and the effective mass, and this effective mass just represents the fact that you're talking about a few electrons, but there is all this background lattice which normalizes, changes the mass of this affected electron. In fact, these are theories worked out by Walter Cohn in the 50s and make it possible to understand effect of how electrons move in semiconductors and so on. So effective mass for the electrons in this system is 0.7 electron mass. So now you multiply, you know, 13 and so you get a factor of roughly a 10 square decrease in energy in E and 10 square increase in length. And this factor of 100 coming from, so this factor of 100 coming from effective mass and dielectric constant and the fact that you can continuously change density is what makes all these phenomena, and the fact that you can eliminate disorder almost as much as you can in metals, are the three facts together which make it possible to study these systems. Okay. Are there any questions on the numbers? Because I would now go and explain to what these systems are. I'll just spend 5 minutes on that. Matthew, you look very perplexed. You have a question? No. Okay. Okay, so let me now tell you, I haven't told you what the systems are. So I'll tell you now what these systems are using one example, which is quite generic. So the reason you would not see actually quantum Hall effect in a very thin metal film, no matter how thin you make it, is because no matter how thin you make it, many thousands of lambda levels will be occupied. And the basic physics of going through lambda levels, localized states, which is crucial to seeing quantum Hall effect, let alone fractional quantum Hall effect, I think simply is not going to apply to a thin metal film, which is metallic and as thin as you can make it. It's on the order of 5 angstroms or something, and you can see, even if you make it 5 angstrom, the electron density is going to be enormous, which means the Fermi level will be so much higher than the H bar omega C that you'll probably, I do not know the exact number, but you could have figured it out from these numbers I'm erasing, you will have a few thousand lambda levels occupied. And typically, quantum Hall effect disappears, you know, by the time you go to some finite 10, depending on your sample and all of this. Okay, so what are these systems? Okay, the quintessential system is a gallium arsenide, aluminium arsenide heterojunction. So you have aluminium arsenide. Really what one uses is an alloy of gallium aluminium arsenide. But that's just a detail for our purpose. And you have gallium arsenide. And the most important thing is that one can always draw a picture like that for anything. Most important thing here is that this interface is really atomically short. Okay, that's the most important thing. So what I'm drawing is the energy level diagram in the direction of growth, okay? And everything that is made possible, you know, careers of many of us, is made possible by this growth technique called MBE growth, which makes this interface atomically sharp. When I say atomically sharp, it really is atomically sharp, meaning the fluctuations on that interface, if you actually measure the root mean square fluctuation in the interface, it's less than one atomic monolayer. It's a complete miracle, but it happens by very controlled growth. And so because this is very sharp, you can now think of confining the electrons near this interface in this direction. And the way one does that, conceptually easiest would be to just put a metal gate here and push these levels up and down. But that's not what is done, because that's kind of difficult to do. It's not so easy to metallize aluminum arsenide, but those are details. The way one actually does it is that you put some dopants here.
This is a three-dimensional picture you're
drawing, right? This is a section of the band structure in the z-direction.
Uh-huh. Just that. Is that going to the black hole?
Right. So yes, absolutely. So it's exactly like this in the same. So in XY plane, you have complete translation invariance. It looks exactly the same. So it's a slab. Okay. So it really looks like this. Okay. And they can actually make this atomically sharp up to hundreds of interfaces. It's quite a miracle. Okay. So you put some silicon dopants here. So often it's silicon. So what the silicon does is they release electrons, and this is how you make three-dimensional transistors. You know, you take silicon, you put phosphorus in there, phosphorus releases electrons, and you have a low electron density that you can control with the electric field. Here, silicon turns out to be the dopant, because silicon has the right valence electrons, and it releases electrons. And a very naive way, you can say these electrons see lower energy state available there, and they just go over there. Well, they cannot continue going over there forever, because the moment they go over there, they are leaving a positive charge. So a dipole sets up. So the potential looks now different. The potential looks... So let me keep this thing. I noticed colored chalk here, so I'm going to make use of it. So the potential in a cartoon will look something like this. So let me just now expand this region. So you now have something. I'm exaggerating. These two will be farther apart. You have a triangular type, but not quite triangular potential well, where the electrons will be confined. So what is the let me just write down the single particle part of the Hamiltonian, just a single particle part. So the single particle part would be that you have, so I'm going to use bad notation. So H of Z will be equal to, you have some kinetic energy, and you have this confinement potential, V of Z. Okay, so the confinement potential is what I drew here. V of Z, let me call it V of Z, not V Z. V of Z. And this confinement potential is an electrostatic problem. If you know the dopant density, the thicknesses, you can calculate the confinement potential without any electrons here. And you may say, well, it's very simple now. You just solved an undergraduate quantum mechanics problem that the energy levels here up to a certain number of bound levels, typically 3 or 4. Okay? And so the total wave function for this system will then look like, if I write down the total wave function, that would look like psi of xyz is e to the power I kr psi iz, where k, where r is, well, k is kx, ky, and I'm assuming isotropy in xy plane, because usually one has that, and this is xy. So what you have now, the original electronic motion, which is a three-dimensional motion, now breaks up into a part which is quantized in z direction, and a part that's purely plane wave-like, okay? Right. So Professor Gross asked exactly the question that one needs to know. What is the splitting will now determine whether you have confinement or not. And this splitting, as you can see, you can control by this dopant. And the story is more complex. You can control it not just with the dopant, but also by adding a metal gate here and applying electric field across the interface. And in fact, growers are very clever. Mansoor Shaygan told us the other day, they sometimes put a gate even here. So it can be controlled quite a bit. And the splitting, which is another parameter that I did not write down deliberately, can be varied from 0.1 MeV to 100 MeV easily in these systems, in gallium arsenide. Over 4 orders of magnitude, it can be varied.
Can you define the word gate?
Oh, gate is just a metal plate.
Just a piece of metal.
Just a piece of metal, that's all. You want to apply an extra electric field, that's all it is. The word gate comes from, in silicon MOSFET, that's all you have. In silicon MOSFET is exactly the same system, except this is silicon dioxide. You don't dope it, you just put a metal gate and attract the electrons close to that. So you can see this number, and then you say, okay, if I'm low temperature now, and low density, so I'll have a Fermi level here somewhere, EF. And I have some formulas. I mean, EF will be proportional to electron density in 2 dimensions, but I'll write down the precise formula. So, if I can find...
Will it let me
You control E by the gate voltage also?
Yeah, well, you control E by density. The way I want to think about it is that it's just a one plate of a capacitor. Okay, so this is just a capacitor, one plate of a capacitor. Electron density controls it. So let me write down a little bit more of theory. I'm a theorist, I should write down some more formulas. Yes? 10th of an MeV is 1.2 Kelvin. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the equation, so let me just try to answer this question by writing down some equation, okay? So what is the equation that this object follows? Remember, we are using effective mass approximation, so this part remains exactly that. This is called effective mass approximation. What that means, and I don't see Walter Kohn here, he introduced this theory. What this basically means is that if you're talking about length scales, which are large compared to lattice size, and we are talking about length scales which are 100 angstroms. Remember, our Bohr radius is 100 angstroms. So you are talking about length scales 100 angstrom of that order. Then you can forget about the lattice. You can take the system to be a continuum, and all the lattice and bands and all these complications do is that they give you an effective dielectric constant and an effective effective mass. You change the electron mass. It's a pure one electron effect. You change the electron mass from 1 to whatever the number is, and change the dielectric constant from 1 to whatever the number is, which in principle you can calculate, but you have to do a three-dimensional band structure calculation, and you've got the result. And in this particular case, effective mass approximation involves kappa going to, as I said, what did I write down, 12 or 13, whatever, 13 I believe, and m star going to 0.07 ME. This is the effect of all the other bands, everything else solid state, and you can rest it. So the electron energy now, so the electron energy is quantized now, and electron energy of this system now looks like h bar squared k squared over 2m plus EI. And this is two-dimensional because k is a two-dimensional vector. And so to solve for psi iz, you have to solve this equation now. Oh, they do it all the time. It's a whole game. You could have a... Oh, that's what they do. I was going to come to that. And zero dimension. So what you can do now, and that's already done, many of the effects I talked about, like the Kondo problem, what they do now, there are two ways. Since you asked, let me just tell you. What they do now, they have two ways of confining it to one dimension. One is that they can literally do it structurally, etch the thing out to make it very thin in this direction. But they do something much cleverer. What they do, they lithographically, they put metal gates, which then they use electrostatic confinement. Both are done, and one-dimensional systems, in the same sense, these are two-dimensional systems, exist, and we have several talks on that. We have two or three visitors coming, experimentalists will tell us about that, Amir Yacoubi. One-dimensional systems, which are really one-dimensional over 10 micron length, has been made this way. This is not easy to do, but I think one-dimensional physics is coming very soon to all of us. And zero-dimensional then you etch in the third direction and make just a box, okay? And that also, those are called quantum dots. In fact, as much work go on, I would say that quantum dot and quantum words, if you look at physical review B, there are probably 10 times as many papers experimental on that than in quantum Hall effect. Because there are not everybody can do quantum Hall effect. You need high magnetic field and pure sample, but if you have a sample, you can do that. So all those things do take place. But the basic physics is, the basic confinement is here. Now, what is this V effective? You now have to solve for this. V effective is not, if V effective is just V confinement, let me call this thing V confinement, then it would be very simple and I would not be writing down any equations. Unfortunately, V effective is somewhat more complicated because you have to first take into account the fact that once you do this, there are electrons here, and those electrons will create a potential itself that's called the Hartree potential. You have to include that because this is now an inhomogeneous system. But that's not enough. These electrons, as we know, are strongly interacting objects. Hartree potential is nothing but just the electrostatic potential, just the Coulomb potential, classical. You have to include what is called exchange correlation potential. Well, Walter Kohn comes to our rescue again. There is a very famous theory called Kohn-Sham theory, which tells us that even with electron-electron interaction, effective problem remains one electron-like. And if you know this, which of course in general you do not, but there are approximations for this, you can solve this, and the Hartree potential, you have to solve Poisson's equation, and n of z is going to be sum over all I. If you're doing it at finite temperature, the Fermi factor, and okay, so you have to now solve these three equations 1, 2, 3, 4, for a particular form for VXC that you have to get somehow. That's for that, if you really want to calculate VXC, you cannot.
Yes. There's two pieces of material that put together.
That's correct. That's
correct.
And aluminum. Let's say make it pure aluminum arsenide, just to make life simple.
All the aluminum.
So the question is, so let me go to the question you're asking. What you are saying, the problem should be much more complicated because it's not a translation invariant problem. So in this I have assumed. Yeah, the confinement potential, what I'm writing, confinement potential is just the potential, this thing, okay? But of course, the actual system is much more complicated. If aluminum arsenide and gallium arsenide have very different dielectric constant, then there is an innate charge here that you have to take into account. The problem is not this simple, and in fact, when I write down the Hamiltonian, you'll see, but all those things are basic electrodynamic solid-state physics effects that can be incorporated in this and is done. And let me just tell you that these energy levels are known to an accuracy which is good enough that experimentalists use the calculated energy levels to figure out what density they have. Meaning, any direct experimental technique of measuring density is not accurate, as accurate as these energy level calculations themselves. I mean, you know, this is basically like quantum chemistry calculations now, except VXCZ. I know because the most accurate calculation of this, I did that with Frank Stern, and it's a paper that's very popular in the engineering community because they use it to basically get these energy levels, okay? And it's a very standard thing. It's called Kohn-Schramm equation or density functional theory. It's done extensively in chemistry and band structure physics. Here, the new twist is you are doing it in one dimension and you have to take into account this confinement. But in any case, finally, what we want is this object, okay? This object. And then you have these K levels. You have certain density. So what would happen is that you fill two-dimensional K states up to Kf, which will give you Fermi energy F, and you can just very easily see that if you just do a counting, so the counting will go, you count all the two-dimensional states, so this thing has to be proportional to your electron density, Ns, so that means that if you do this integral, you go from 0 to Kf, so let's forget, so basically you have Kf square going as Ns. So that means EF, which is proportional to Kf square, is proportional to Ns. Okay, so the energy, so this Fermi energy increases or decreases according to just the density that you put in. And if you put a lot of electrons, then the second subband will be occupied, and it's not quite two-dimensional anymore. And as I said, the wave function here, there is a wave function here, it's not strictly two-dimensional, there is a wave function which looks like this, which is given by this, an actual Coulomb interaction, so V Coulomb in these systems, V Coulomb of R, which normally is 1 over R, or let's say E square over kappa R, here will change. And you may think the change will be very simple, that it will be just like E square kappa square root of R square plus lambda square, where lambda is some effective width here, this effective width. But actually, you can see that this will be a very bad approximation. This will be a very bad approximation because it's not going to interpolate between the limits correctly. Because you want the system, if the separation between the two electrons is very, very short, okay, you do not want it this to become a constant. It's becoming a constant. If R is very small, it's becoming a constant. If R is very small, you know it should be logarithmic. If R is large, so what you do now this is where you define your V now in this basis. You have a basis now, you see. And in this basis, you define your V. So you have a basis. This provides you a basis. So to do many-body theory now, you really have to take These are all real, so I'm not writing down two of them as star, but because they are all real. So let's say yes. Yeah, because it should be an effective, like a two-dimensional Coulomb gas, right? It's like rods then, only. You know, and the solution of this in two dimension gives you log, so it's. But you don't need to worry about those things if you have this thing. And then you have to take the actual Fourier transform of three-dimensional Coulomb interaction in two-dimension. And normally that's just this, but in this problem it's much more complicated. Because in this problem, in general, you may have those two dielectric constants to be different. And so you have to include the innate charge also. This causes a lot of problem in actual calculations, which fortunately, if you're doing field theory, then you don't need to worry about it because this just defines the parameters that go into a Lagrangian. But this makes the problem non-translation invariant. You have a Z plus Z prime piece, and that's obvious, right? It's not translation invariant. And if the dielectric constants are very different, you really have to take that into account. For silicon MOSFET, this is a large effect. For gallium arsenide, it's a negligible effect because gallium arsenide and aluminum arsenide have the same dielectric constant to about 5%. So what I drew here is just this thing. How do two electrons interact when via Coulomb interaction when they are, you know, this includes all the virtual. And to do many body theory, you really need to use this now, but that's just to tell you what complications one has. Okay. Yes. Yes.
Short distances, I thought I would see a three-dimensional potential. I no longer can see both the confines.
This time, you should not know it's a finite problem.
At very short, yeah. So that's correct. So
small,
right, small, yeah. Let me see. For large, no. That's so for. If your R is very small, then the fact that there is it's quantized in the other direction would matter, because it's I mean you're thinking classically, right? If R is very small, the fact that it's quantized, only when R is much, much larger than lambda, the fact that it's confined doesn't matter. Because what difference does it make whether it's confined or not? And then it falls off. That part, I would argue, comes out right. It's the constant. Maybe what I'm saying is wrong. I never use this. I know that this is used. And let me think for a moment.
That's the point. If you can have sufficient eigenspace, then the function of R is 1 over R.
Right, these are not position eigenspaces. Yeah, this is not a position eigenspace, right. It's not a position, it's not a, yeah.
That's my second
right.
Logarithm, but I believe that
it turns out to be logarithm. It is a subtle, more subtle than I thought. I mean, to me it was obvious that if R is very short, it should be different, but maybe it's not so obvious.
But you don't apply directly.
Excuse me?
You don't apply
directly. No, electrodynamics is always three-dimensional.
So why does the motion of the
say it again, please?
Why does the motion of the
lambda is
the thickness. Yeah, lambda is the thickness.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, it's being effective because you're trying to extract an effective.
Yeah, it is an effective interaction, right? This is effective quantum. I mean, this is the quantity one is talking about, okay? This is the quantity, okay? This is what it is. So, this is the Coulomb interaction expressed in this basis, okay? So, this is not the classical interaction, okay? This is Coulomb interaction expressed in this basis. And I believe that the limits of this basis are what I just told you. Okay, 1 over R and log R. Okay. But it's neither 1 over R nor log R in any interesting regime. It's something else in between the two. I mean, this is not even a function of R. This is a function of K. Okay. So, you know, this is a function of K. I mean, so it's a very complicated object. Okay. What I'm saying is that if you now take a Fourier transformation back into R space. K is Q. Did I write Q there? Sorry. If you now Fourier transform it back to two-dimensional R space, this V of T is not going to give you 1 over R. Okay? It'll give you 1 over R only when R is very large, and it's going to give you a log R. And the reason when R is very small, the interaction is really two-dimensional. It's a two-dimensional Coulomb interaction then. And
your wave function is a one-dimensional wave function describing sheets of electrons, not...
I mean,
I think actually
it's going to be.
You're fixing the R.
Right.
Fixing the R so it's like.
It's like this. Like this. And spread out in this direction. Yeah. It looks like this, right? It looks like this. You have two charges, but they're confined along this direction, in this direction. Anyway, I don't think this is a. I mean, here it is, okay? If you do not want it, I mean, nobody ever Fourier transforms back into R space. You don't need to because you do your many-body theory in Q space, okay? So I want to go on to now interesting stuff. This is just an introduction to the system. Yes?
Just so I feel I have
Sure.
So I'm having a little trouble getting an idea what the distances are here. In other words, you have the relaxation distance.
Yeah, so...
You talk about a dielectric
right.
constant, which would assume you're already at such distances that it's like a continuum.
Right.
So I'm trying to get
right, it is a continuum. So this is, these distances, okay, of the order of 1,000 angstrom.
Okay, and that's determined
okay, and this
by some intrinsic
That determined by density and how many dopants you put, which determines density, yes.
Are those dopants?
That's correct. No, usually they are put just in a sheet, very far. You don't want it to permeate all the space, because then there'll be too much scattering. So this is called modulation doping. The profile, right.
The profile going into the gallium-arsenide, what sets those distances for, you know, for the way we think about the background concentration?
Correct. It is.
And you can control that.
Absolutely. And it's, yes.
So, give me an idea. That's like 1,000 angstrom kind of...
Yes, the depletion, what you call depletion length is about 1,000 angstrom.
And how does that relate to the density or to the density of the free...
Right, so the free charge density is of the order of 10 to the power 11. You can change it from 10 to the power 9 to, let's say, about 5 to 10 to the power 11. This is the total freedom you have. You cannot do it any more than this because of the restrictions you are alluding to. Okay? Any more than that, you'll have breakdown and all kinds of other things because the electric field will be too strong. Okay? So, this is the range, roughly, in which you can change your electron density by this technique. Okay? I hope it answers. I mean, this is a huge subject by itself. Yeah, this is a huge subject by itself, this confinement. People play all kinds of games and tricks, including a lot in Quest right here, this confinement. But this is the range.
Okay. Shankar, in your lowest sub-band, yes. That width is only about 350.
Well, it depends on how you define width, right? I mean, you don't really have a width quantum, yeah. It's of the order of... Yeah, it's of the order of 50 to 100 angstrom. That's correct. Yeah, 50 to 100 angstrom. And it is often ignored, yes. Okay, so let me now go on to, so far I have been just talking about the system, okay? I will tell you some interesting...
Do I know why gallium and arsenic are special, or do I not need to know?
No. You need to know anything that comes to your mind.
I'm trying to become a real physicist.
Okay. Okay. If you're real, so this is the experiment, don't matter. So, yes. So what was the question? I didn't get.
So, why is gallium and arsenic special?
Why is gallium arsenide? And the reason it's gallium arsenide is it has the right band gap and so on and so forth. It's a technological push, and also you can make it very, very pure. Arsenic is actually not a very good material. But gallium arsenide, specifically because it has the... let me just tell you what the motivation for this thing. The motivation for this thing is not quantum Hall effect, as you should have surmised. It's quantum well lasers and high mobility transistors. In fact, if you have a cell phone, then every cell phone has these systems in there, because these are very low noise transistors, okay? And quantum well lasers also use this. They actually use something else also. So motivation has always been the band gaps are right, and you can make it very, very pure. But there is nothing, people do not make it just with gallium arsenide.
There's one more reason. You can grow these two different components.
Yeah, lattice matched. This is lattice matched. I should have. Yeah, what it means, I forgot that. What it means is that the lattice constant of gallium arsenide is within, 1%, not I think. It's basically equal to lattice constant of aluminum arsenide. So you can grow it pseudomorphically. Remember, I emphasize the fact that this is sharp. Nobody asked me why. Well, first, because people who do it are very careful. But second, because the lattice constants are the same, so you can really grow one on the top of the other. And if this lattice mismatch is more than 3%, it's very hard to do it. And in fact, that's the problem one has in silicon. You know, one would like to do all these things with silicon. Germanium silicon allows you. It's a big subject. Let me just go on. Okay. In fact, I do a lot of work on this. If you're interested in it, we could discuss this. This is a... Understanding MBE growth is a very, very big subject by itself. So what I want to talk about now is physics of two of these layers together, bilayer system. Okay. And that actually will bring in our program. And so far what I told you has a lot to do with our program, but you will not hear any talks on these things. So what I want to talk about is physics of bilayer systems and how you can have all kinds of quantum phase transitions in bilayer systems. And just to emphasize, so I told you how one makes a bilayer, or sometimes called double quantum well systems. I'll draw one for you. And just to make connection with our director's introduction to this lunch talks, our program has a lot of physics of bilayer systems in it. If you look at our conference, you'll find more than one third of the talks were on bilayer systems. And Aaron Pinczuk and I recently edited a book on quantum Hall effect. More than one third of the book is devoted to physics of bilayer structures. And if you look at all our seminars, I think it's a safe bet to say about one third will be on bilayer systems. So I'm following the instructions rather scrupulously, okay? So a bilayer would be two of these things put together, okay? So this is your, so let's just continue now and put another quantum Hall there, okay? So, you have aluminum arsenide here, gallium arsenide here, aluminum arsenide again. Just put two of those interfaces together, gallium arsenide and then aluminum arsenide again. Okay? Now let's concentrate on these two things where you have, and let's say you do all the tricks that I just told you. And you have electrons in both of these layers, okay? Some electron density, which you'll take nominally to be equal. Just, so let's say you have NS here, NS there, but I will sometimes call them N right or N. They could be different in principle, but I'll start by calling them the same. You have two electron densities, same.
Sorry, are they symmetrically modulation doped?
No, you cannot symmetrically modulation dope them. That's another chapter, because these interfaces are not of equivalent quality. And once you spend some time, in fact, I asked him a number of questions, they have to put gates to make them exactly equal. You have to balance them. When you make a structure, just the basic structure is never like this, because you have internal electric field and so on and so forth. This, for reasons that we still do not completely understand, gallium arsenide, aluminum arsenide growth doesn't follow on Fragger relation, meaning gallium arsenide growing on aluminum arsenide is much better than aluminum arsenide growing on gallium arsenide. We have some understanding where that happens. So one of these interfaces is poorer in general, even though this problem is going away. So they have to do some things, but they know exactly what to do to make it balanced. And you can check that it's balanced. Okay? So they actually apply electric field to make it balanced. Again. So you have two layers. So from now on, the model I'll use... In between the two?
Yeah.
It's a variable. That's what it's coming to. Okay. So you have now three parameters in the problem. D, N1, N2, but let's say if they could be just NS. Okay. So you can immediately see why theorists like this very much. Because now you have another parameter to tune your interaction. The electron density tunes the interaction in the layer, and the separation tunes the interaction in this direction. Okay. So I'll come to that. So let me just, okay, so you're asking questions which are my favorite, because those are things I always do and almost everybody else in this room neglects. Yes, this thickness certainly should be included in all the calculations, and any calculation that I'll show you, if in my calculation include them. But to do them, you actually have to do all this work. No, it's not a trivial point. To do this, you have to do all this work, which for any qualitative physics is unimportant. It's only for the numbers they're important. Okay? So if you leave this out, what you're doing, you're taking a Coulomb interaction to be just 1 over R in the layer. Well, so that will be multiplied by some number. It will change. So there is nothing qualitative, okay? So for our purpose, what we are saying is that the model we'll use is two 2D layers separated by a distance D. So going back to the pure 2D model now, so the interaction in these two layers by themselves, okay, is just e to the power... Coulomb interaction in these layers is just 2 pi e square divided by kappa q. Now I'm ignoring all these complications I told you and taking it just to be two-dimensional Coulomb interaction, okay? These are the two-dimensional. But on the other hand, this interaction is 2 pi e square kappa q e to the power minus qd. Now you see what I have done. This is a problem that has U1 symmetry now. Because the interaction, there are two kinds of electrons now, okay? Electrons interact, so let me number them, 1, 2. So V11 is equal to V22, but that's not equal to V12, okay? So if you have no tunneling between the two layers, okay, if you have no tunneling between the layers, then this is the whole story, and you can ask a lot of questions. It is now interesting because by changing D, you can make the interaction in the layer and interaction between the layers vary. And it turns out that many quantum phase transitions, this is really the tuning parameter. And experimentalists, we had several talks on this already, both in the conference and in our program. Experimentalists can do absolutely exquisite things. They can actually really do what you can write down in papers, changing this thing. Okay? So this is now a two-component fermion problem. We know of one very famous two-component fermion problem, spin. But this is different. This is not spin. We'll call it pseudo-spin, and that's what it's called in the literature. And the reason it's a pseudo spin is that it doesn't have the full SU2 symmetry, because interaction in ordinary spin, interaction between spin up down is the same as interaction between spin up up and spin up down, down down. Here that's not true. So instead of, so this has symmetry 1, and spin, regular spin, has symmetry SU2. Okay? Yeah.
The gallium arsenide is very thin.
This gallium arsenide? Yeah, it could be. It could.
Is it much smaller than D?
If it's not much smaller than D, then what all the things I'm telling you is not going to happen. Right, right. And again, when in field theory, if you just do a Lagrangian, then those issues don't come in. But you can actually investigate that very systematically using that. Okay? And it should be, the gallium arsenide layer should be much, much smaller than the this separation between them for this analogy to exactly apply. There's a question here.
There's also a system in which if you make a single worldwide.
Yeah, those are more, right, I actually drew that. So if you really take just one wide well and put a lot of electrons in it, then it looks like this. I'm exaggerating, but it really looks like this, okay? And then electrons here and here behave the same way. Mm-hmm. And again, it turns out that it really is pretty much like that with some changes. A thing that I'll tell you are independent, meaning even if you include these solid state corrections, what I'm telling you is still true. But I will not explain them in the talk because they are details and one knows how to include them. Now you may say, okay, what corresponds to the magnetic field in this problem? Because after all, when you do spin physics, we tune the coupling by applying magnetic field. Okay? And typically that coupling is, you know, G mu B for spin physics, where G is the gyromagnetic ratio. Here, that coupling is nothing but letting electrons tunnel from one layer to another. Okay? Which you can do because you have intrinsic tunneling, but it turns out this tunneling you can control by applying a parallel magnetic field. I don't want to get into that. But having a tunneling here mixes these two states, and that's exactly like a pseudo-spin magnetic field, okay? Because tunneling will just add, you know, this plus complex conjugate to your Hamiltonian, okay? So now you have, in principle, four energy scales. Energy scale for interaction in each layer. Yes, but then you cannot do it in one system. Then you have to make several systems. People do that. It is done in three different ways. One is the way you suggested, which is many different Ds. The other is that you take this one system that I just drew, which is what Mansoor Shaghan does at Princeton. He takes one system where the self-consistent potential splits it into two, and then he changes the density, and that changes it. And third way is just applying a parallel magnetic field, because parallel magnetic field couples to the orbital motion also and changes the tunneling. Again, all of these are understood how they do it. Even the parallel magnetic field, I think, is not completely understood. But Steve is here. He understands it. I was reading his paper. I didn't understand it. Yes?
The magnetic field is always so strong that you don't have to worry about distortion because of the sunny geometry.
That's certainly true. No. The orbital corrections are very small. Yes, very small. Even though I'm saying that based more on an intuitive feel, nobody has investigated in great detail. You know, people are asking me in this program, you know what, I mean, I think Steve is worrying about it. It hasn't been investigated. It's used as a parameter. But I think basically what you're saying is what people believe. Right. It hasn't. Apparently, one of McDonald's students looked at it, but it was never published. And I think what he did was pretty elementary. Anyway, so this is the system. And so you have this plus tunneling. So you have four energy scales in the problem. So you can imagine it's four energy scales, all tunable. What are the energy scales? RS1 is the dimensionless separation between the electrons in the layer in one well. RS2 is the same in the other well. Usually they're equal, but they don't have to be. D is the separation between them. So D tells you how much away it is from SU2 symmetry, you know, the difference between SU2 and E1. And T is the term that breaks the E1 symmetry. Okay? You have four dimensionless parameters plus temperature. It's a great toy, and experimentalists can make this toy exactly as we are talking about. Yeah, well, I mean, this is again another issue. You're asking the questions that I usually worry about. T and D are related, but they don't have to be because of this parallel magnetic field. And in general, in any calculations, you should calculate T from the TAN structure, but that can be done. So even though T and D are related, it's not nonsensical to think of them as independent parameters, and which is what I'll do. Okay? So let me tell you something very simple that immediately comes out in this bilayer thing, which is tangential in our program, because I do it, but we didn't invite anybody to talk about it. So it's collective modes in these systems. It's one of my favorite subjects. So if you have a single two-dimensional layer, Okay, then you have a plasmon mode, okay? Just plasmon mode. What is a plasmon mode? It's just as you have plasmon oscillation in electron gas, okay? It's just a plasmon mode which goes as some constant. In fact, it goes exactly as this. Okay? So it's a square root of Q. So if I draw it, omega versus Q, it has the square root of Q dispersion. Let me remind you, in three dimension, this quantity is just a constant. Okay? So omega plasmon 3D is square root of 4 pi N3D E squared divided by kappa M according to this form. In two dimension, plasma oscillations go to zero energy at long wavelength, and it's just a fact that in two dimension Coulomb interaction is not as strong as it is in three dimension. Okay? Alright, so now suppose, so this is known, predicted, experimentally observed in all these two-dimensional systems. It's a very well-established phenomenon. This is, in fact, what we do not understand about this, it's a funny story, and I just got an email from Aaron Pingzuk asking me, what we do not understand about this is that, why does this simple formula work so well? Okay, this simple formula seems to work up to, down to a density of 10 to the power minus 9 centimeter square, which in RS is 20, and I do not have much time to explain it. For RS is equal to 20, this electron system is a very strongly interacting quantum system. It's basically potential energy is 20 times the kinetic energy. You don't expect a leading order formula which ignores all of this quantum fluctuation effect to be valid. And in fact, Aaron Pingzuk has been making samples for the last 3 years, going to lower and lower density, hoping to see deviation from this. And his points are right on this all the way. So to the extent there is a problem with this, it's understanding why it works as well as it does. There should be corrections, but there should be no corrections here, by the way. That, again, is Kohn's theorem. Can't escape Walter Kohn in solid state physics. It's F sum rule. It's the conservation of current controls that in long wavelength it must be square root of Q. But, you know, at Q over Kf, things which has gone now to Q over Kf is equal to 1. And that's very far from long wavelength. And he still sees this to be within 5%, this formula. But anyway, yes.
So what happens at Wigner crystallization? There must be some big peak.
No, it doesn't have to be. It's thought, so that is aside, since you asked our answer. It's a first order transition, so nothing may happen to the plasma mode. Okay? And there is no theory that says something must. And so basically what happens is, as you know, you have this electron hole continuum also. So you have this thing, and somehow this plasma mode in the liquid phase goes into the phonon mode in the Wigner crystal. Because Wigner crystal phonons, of course, are nothing but plasmons of the electron liquid. Somehow it goes into that, and most likely it goes continuously.
But it must go change the power, right? Because phonon is linearly dispersing.
No? not in electron crystal. That's transverse. Right. Electron crystal, they are exactly this mode, square root of Q. It could be, but it's not a problem that has been studied in great detail, the transition, because remember, we really don't have a theory at RS is equal to 38. Okay, to the extent...
So, one loop of factor is not going to get it.
Right. Okay, so now what I want to talk about, this is very well understood. What I want to talk about, what happens now when you have two layers? So, you bring the second layer in, okay? So, if they did not interact, meaning if D was infinity, then it's very simple what would happen. You will have two degenerate plasmons on top of each other. Okay? One and two both here, if they didn't interact. Now you let them interact. You say that, no, they interact via this e to the power minus QD divided by Q interaction. After all, it's a simple interaction, we all know. Well, you don't have to do any calculation. You know what would happen without doing any calculation. There'll be what is called level repulsion. Now they know they exist, so the modes will repel each other. In fact, in this repulsion, you can think of it a number of different ways. One of the modes, in fact, will become linearly dispersive. Okay? So what you then find is that if you let them interact, then one more still says square root of Q, but its coefficient now is N1 plus N2. And again, you don't need to do any calculation to get that. That mode is the overall plasma oscillation of the whole system. The system doesn't care. It's the total charge density moving in phase. So that's the so-called in-phase mode. And the other one, which is the out-of-phase mode, in fact, becomes linear in Q. Okay? Linear in Q, that's the out-of-phase mode. And this out-of-phase mode is what is happening is that the I will not be able to draw it, the electron densities are fluctuating exactly out of phase. It's a neutral mode for this system. Okay? But this is not a Goldstone mode, because all you have done is just brought two layers together. But this has all the properties that one, I mean, one can think of it as a Goldstone mode, just as one can think of phonons in a regular crystal as a Goldstone mode. But I think no new understanding develops. If anything, confusion develops from that. So, right. It's all you have now is a U1 symmetry. I'm not letting them tunnel. You do have U1 symmetry here. Oh yes, you have U1 because they're not tunneling.
Change the charge.
Yeah, you're changing the charge continuously. That's all you have done. I mean, I didn't follow what you said. You have U1 symmetry here, but I will not break U1 symmetry. Okay? So this is what. So the quiz to this class is what happens when I now break the U1 symmetry. I do what Professor Gross just said. I let tunneling come in. So this picture is for t is equal to 0. Okay? I now let them tunnel. Okay? So I'm breaking that U1 symmetry. What would happen? The first thing you should be able to say, just based on what I told you, nothing would happen to this mode in a leading order, because this mode is just the overall density oscillation. It should be totally insensitive to those things, you know, just determined by, there'll be some higher order corrections, but nothing would happen. And that's exactly what you find. But what would happen to this mode? In fact, you know what would happen. It will develop a gap. Okay, it will develop a gap. So it will develop a gap. So for t non-zero, it will now develop a gap. Okay? Now you may say that's kind of trivial, because I know when I have single particle tunneling, I have a gap called delta SAS, because when I have single particle tunneling, my levels, you know, my originally I had these levels, they now intermix, and I have symmetric level going through an antisymmetric level, and their separation, delta SAS, in this simple picture is given by nothing but 2t in this. If you just have a single tunneling parameter tied binding, this is nothing but chemical hybridization. You know, you have bring two atoms together, you get symmetric and antisymmetric levels. That's all it is. So this is delta SAS. So you say, well, it's very trivial, because after all, I know my single particle energy excitations, or single particle excitations, must have a gap. Originally, I didn't have a gap in single particle excitation. Now I have a gap in single particle excitation. So I don't need to know anything about symmetry. It will split up. But this argument will tell you that this is delta SAS. And that's completely wrong. This is not delta SAS at all. This number actually is very different from delta SAS. It could be larger than delta SAS or smaller than delta SAS. And in fact, this gap, which I'll call delta plasmon, T not equal to zero, actually goes as delta SAS for delta SAS greater than one in some dimensionless unit. In fact, goes as square root of delta SAS for delta SAS small. And the reason is this mode is very strongly affected by many body effects, okay? And first thing that would happen is that it's physically it's very obvious what happens. This mode now, you can think of this mode as taking an electron from here and putting it up there, okay, and bring it back. Well, when you do that, you set up a dipole field. You're taking an electron, putting it up there, you're mixing the symmetric and antisymmetric, so you set up a dipole field. So if nothing else, now I have to use a little theory language, you have to add all the vacuum polarization diagrams. That you have to add. So basically, you have to add all these diagrams, plus so on, where you have one here and two here. Okay? Pull up this, just one and two start at delta SAS. Pull up this infinite series, of course, to be shifted above from delta SAS. But it's exactly what in electrostatics we call Clausius-Mossotti correction. If you have a confined system and you create a charge density, you create any excitation, there will be a dipole field trying to screen it, and you have to give a little bit more cost in energy. It's very simple, nothing quantum mechanical about it. But I told you it could be below. How can it be below? That actually is an effect of vortex correction. Because what happens is that the basic thing, this, is not just this anymore. You really have to include all the other interactions. It has only been done later, but you should really include everything. And it's actually, we did it, and you find that it could be below, and Aaron Pinczuk has measured it, and it actually obeys the theory reasonably well. Okay, so it's a direct verification that the microscopic Hamiltonian, you have very good knowledge of it, and you have quantitative agreement between theory and experiment. But this is not necessarily the most interesting thing.
So when you say that, sorry. That is like the square root of what?
Right.
Is the other energy scale?
Oh, the other energy scale here is there are several energy scales, EF. EF is an energy scale. For example, for what I told you, it's actually a bit more complicated. I mean, you have the screening also, QTFD, okay, and delta SS, yes. So what you need is this to be the larger or smaller. I can give you the paper. I mean, let's discuss it later, okay? It's full, completely analytic, so you can actually follow everything. So this is essentially the energy scale, because the screening length is an important length here. okay, to do the calculations. So. All right, so what I want to talk about, and that's the last thing I want to talk about now, is the question of what happens when you lower the density a lot in this system. And I want to talk about many other things. In particular, I want to talk about meirons. I was reading a paper on meirons. And but I don't think meirons have been seen by the SD, but we should talk about it. okay, so what I want to talk about is that you have these two layers, and Mansoor Shaghan talked about this experiment, his recent experiment, but he's doing it in high field. I am in B is equal to zero completely. Everything I'm telling you has a high field analogy worked out in great details by the so-called Indiana group, Steve Garvin, Alan MacDonald, and their 8 collaborators in one paper and 10 collaborators in the other paper. Okay? 46 page of FizzRep B. Okay? Very nice papers. I read them over the weekend. All those finite fields. But
about time.
Right. It's for this. I know it's honest. That I, for example, I found out that one of the first papers on meirons is David Gross's. I don't know what the paper has. I haven't had a chance to look at that. But I saw that in there. Because I was wondering where you got the terminology from. Where does the terminology come from? You don't explain that. Ah. So you made it up? Or I said, no? Okay, fine. So, now, what I think the Indiana group didn't realize, or if they realized, certainly didn't write it in the paper, is that all this physics can happen in zero field. And the physics that happens here has very big words, like interlayer phase coherence, Josephson effect, superfluidity, meirons, Talapov-Pokrovsky transition, Kostolev-Thouless transition, all these things happen at D is equal to zero. Basic physics is that you have to make interaction much stronger than Fermi energy. So I'll explain to you the B finite, I have nothing to say. It's a very long topic. So what I want to ask is that I have this situation where tunneling is zero. Okay, I have no tunneling, which can always be made by making this thickness very large. I have electron densities in both. So I have some Fermi level in both. Let's take the electron densities to be the same. For this purpose, it doesn't make any difference. Now what I want to ask the question, as I lower the electron density, what are the possible quantum phase transitions of this system? It's a very simple question. I know the Hamiltonian exactly. So the Hamiltonian is, you have kinetic energy, I wrote down all these terms before, so I'm not writing them down, okay? So you have this, and all I want to do is tune the density. So tuning the density will change essentially all of these terms. I'm going to lower the density. So I have to tell you first what would have happened if I just had one layer. Okay? So the question is, what are the phase transitions possible in an electron gas in two dimension as you lower density? Okay. Well, that actually has been, again, discussed in this program in great length. And instead of density, I'm going to use this parameter, dimensionless parameter, which is RS, which is essentially interparticle separation measured in unit of Bohr radius. So it's proportional to N minus half. Okay? And basically what it is basically what it is I already gave you the things that it is nothing but that E Coulomb divided by E Fermi. That's all it is. When it's very large, Coulomb interaction is very large. When it's very small, Coulomb interaction is very small. Metals, to give you an idea, metals, all metals have between 2 and 5.6. In all metals fall in this. So this is a single parameter that tells you whether a continuum electron Hamiltonian is strong or weakly interacting. When RS is much, much smaller than 1, it's weakly interacting, and one knows how to develop a theory. When RS is very large, one doesn't know how to develop a theory, but at least weak coupling normalization group tells you there is a Fermi surface and until the Wigner crystal comes. So what are the possible phases? So I'm going to write schematics. RS goes to infinity here, 0 here. Okay? So you have an electron liquid regime somewhere. Probably I'm going to say T. I want to be very precise, since it's one of the few things I've thought a little bit about in the last few days. Let's make T like 10 to the power minus 9 or 10 to the power minus 8 Kelvin. The reason is, it's quite likely that at T is equal to 0, this system goes superconducting due to the Kohn-Luttinger mechanism. But so we'll keep it finite, but very small. So for all practical purposes, there's zero temperature quantum phase transition. Then up to some point, it will be a paramagnetic electron liquid. Well, if you really want to be precise, then you can say electron gas. Interaction effects are not strong, then paramagnetic electric liquid, and then at some RS value, and this RS value varies from 2 to 30 depending on what approximations you are doing to calculate your strong coupling. As you know, when you have a strong coupling problem, unless you're lucky and somebody gives an exact solution, you're not going to have unanimity. You do some approximation, you get a result, and then you argue with your referees and friends about how good your approximations are. But all the approximations find that there's a paramagnetic to ferromagnetic transition. Whether it happens or not, we still do not know. Because in these systems, it will be very difficult to directly test a ferromagnetic system. Why? Because of these very few electrons. You cannot just do magnetization and hope to see it, because you're looking for one part in 10 to the power 6 effect. Then, you have a ferromagnetic liquid, and then eventually, more or less around RS40, you have Wigner crystal. Okay. So that's what happens in one layer. So in one layer, and why do you have ferromagnetic liquid? Well, that's actually very easy to explain using perturbation theory. And it's so easy that I'm actually going to do it. You can calculate the energy of this interacting system, one layer, in expansion in RS, the density parameter. Well, just on dimensional ground, you know that the leading time is going to go as RS square, because leading time is just kinetic energy is going to go as EF, and 1 over RS square is EF. The second term, which is negative, the exchange energy, so-called Hartree-Fock energy, which is just one integral, you know is also going to go as some constant divided by RS. Why? Because it must go, this is just the Coulomb energy, you know, the exchange energy. It must go as some constant over RS. And this constant, I believe 1.2, but I hope I have it written down here. This constant in two dimension is, in fact, it is 1.2, okay. And in three dimension, it's 0.44. It's exactly known, okay. It's minus sign, because exchange energy will have the opposite sign. And this, by the way, was a source of a lot of discussions in our program already. This is your negative compressibility term. This is the term that gives you negative. It's a trivial effect. I just did not understand why you were spending so much time talking about it. It's just this negative term. It means it's a negative compressibility. Then the next order term is some constant. And then the next order term actually in three dimensions goes as RS log RS. Well, just to show that I have done a little work, I'll write them down. But there. It can be calculated, okay? All of this can be calculated because it's systematic expansion. So C is 0.43, and the next term is 0.028 RS log RS.
Is this the theory that people like
Galvani
are doing?
Yes, this is the series Gell-Mann and Bruckner did for three dimension. Mm-hmm. Okay, and actually, well, with a little help from Onsager for the next term. Okay, but in two dimension, it's analytic dependence is different. You do not have this RS. I mean, I'll write down the Gell-Mann series also. Gell-Mann series would be that I wrote down. What it is the Gell-Mann-Bruckner series. 0.42. In fact, the two things that I wrote down are for 3D. So let me just correct it. I'm sorry about this. Let me write it down. I wrote it down. I was writing down the wrong formula. So this is 0.38. Sorry about that. 0.38 minus, it comes with minus sign the next term, 0.72 RS log RS. Okay, and in Gell-Mann's Bruckner series, this is 0.44, this is 0.43, and this term in fact is plus 0.028 log RS. Okay, so and you know, then you have higher order corrections that you can do numerical work. So all I have done is taken an interacting Coulomb system and have calculated its total energy in a systematic expansion in 1 over density. Okay, that's all this is. And it can be done. In principle, it can be done to any order. In practice, it basically stops here. Okay? So now you look at it and let's just concentrate on this. We'll ignore everything else. Like good theories, you're going to ignore everything else. This is called Hartree-Fock theory, if you just keep this. What it means is that you're taking into account electron kinetic energy and electron exchange energy more or less accurately. Much of quantum chemistry is based on this. And all of mean field, you know, BCS theory, for example, is a generalization of this. Many of the nonlinear sigma model-based calculations, field theoretic calculations for our systems, is basically when you put parameters, all you are doing is putting this in. Okay? So I'm going to include only up to this. Now you look at something very curious. What you find is that these two terms have opposite sign. Clearly, if density is very high, this term dominates. And then you don't need to worry about this term. And we all know that kinetic energy doesn't want ferromagnetic system. Kinetic energy wants the spin to be paramagnetic, because if all the spin flips, Fermi energy goes up, and that costs energy. Okay? So to minimize this term, you will always have, in a quantum system, you will always have a paramagnet. Okay? But if your density is low enough, then this term will dominate over that term. So at some stage, you would want to optimize this term. This is the exchange term. To optimize that, it's much better to make the system go into a ferromagnetic ground state, because if a ferromagnetic ground state, then the electrons will stay away from each other. Okay, because then the orbital part has to be anti-symmetric. If the orbital part is anti-symmetric, they'll stay away from each other. If they stay away from each other, that's good. And so that means this theory says at some...
You're talking about one layer now, right?
Just one layer at this stage.
Real spin, not
I'm talking only real spin at this stage. Only real spin, yes. At some RS is equal to RC, paramagnet to ferromagnet. Okay? Exactly the same thing happens in two-layer also. In fact, if I now draw the phase diagram, what you find is that let me draw the phase diagram quantitatively. Yes. Right. So I will make a comment on that. I mean, your point is absolutely correct and absolutely well taken. I'll make a comment on that in a second. So basically, what you find is that you have some value of RS, RC, where you go from paramagnet to ferromagnet. And what I'm drawing here is a function of D. This is a sketch, and R is the phase diagram, okay? So all of them dimensionalized with QTF or something. Yes? There was a question here? No. Okay, so the point that Eduardo is making is that this theory, I just told you, is an expansion in RS. That means it assumes RS to be small. How can you apply the large RS? In principle, you cannot. But as you know, you all do it. And so you need some justification. Justification comes from these calculations by your colleague, David Separly, who does fixed mode quantum Monte Carlo calculations, which are non-perturbative but very large numerical calculations, and you find there is always a phase transition. You notice that I did not put any number for RC. So if I put number for RC within Hartree-Fock theory, this number would be RS is 2. Okay? Clearly, Hartree-Fock theory overestimates the ferromagnetic state. What David finds is that depending on his way of doing numerical work, this RC is between 10 and 30. But he always finds one. That's the important thing. I'm just establishing principle. Again, like field theory, I don't know what it would happen. Okay, but it would happen. Fine, but that's not the punchline. But now you look at something. If T is equal to zero, if I don't have any tunneling, then eventually this two-component system would want a ferroelectric transition also, very similar to this ferromagnetic transition, because you would say, well, I can lower the exchange energy even more if all the electrons go from one layer to another, just by the argument that if I put the spin, I mean, I did not write. So let me write down the full Hartree-Fock formula. That depends on your approximations. In Hartree-Fock, it turns out to be fully polarized. In Hartree-Fock theory. Separately, 1, 2, 3 differ on it. These are not easy questions to answer numerically. So sometimes he gets partial polarization, sometimes he gets full polarization. Okay, he gets both. And I'm just ignoring those complications because my punchline is not the ferromagnetic thing, okay? So if you write down the total energy now, at some lower density, you will then claim that all the electrons should spontaneously transfer. You should have a charge transfer instability because you can think of this left and right layer as nothing but spin up, spin down, and keeping both occupied is costing a lot of exchange energy. So at some low density, they should spontaneously go from one layer to the other, and you should have a charge transfer instability. And this was not our idea. In fact, the original paper was Alan McDonald's, even though he told me that he thinks it's wrong, so I should not give him credit for it. But he said it in a context in a talk like this when I said it was predicted by Rudin and Wu in 1991. Alan puts his hand up and said, no, actually, I predicted 1988, but you should not give me credit for it because I think it's wrong. Shit, it happened. So you will then conclude that at some density, it will go from two layer to one layer. I'll call it a ferroelectric transition. It's a very bizarre transition. In fact, Mansur Chagan claimed in his talk just the other day that he has seen this transition in a strong field. I personally don't think he has actually seen exactly this. But the transition is exactly the same transition as this. Okay? All the electrons should go from one layer to another. You just want one pseudo-spin occupied now. You want a pseudo-spin polarized system. So this is spin polarized, and this is pseudo-spin polarized. And when I saw this paper, and there are papers from Dan Sui claiming they have seen it, I was very excited and agitated. Because this, of course, cannot happen. You all understand this cannot happen. This is manifestly wrong. This violates quantum mechanics in some major way. This cannot happen. So the quiz is why? What is wrong in the argument? Why can't it happen? The reason it can't happen is that SU2 versus U1 symmetry, yes.
I didn't understand why it shouldn't happen.
Oh, I haven't told you why it should not happen.
Well,
I'm telling you.
It's not manifestly anything.
It's actually, once I tell you, after the fact, it is fairly manifestly obvious. You see, Steve Garvin is amused. He agrees with me, I think. It doesn't happen. It doesn't happen because look, I'm not being facetious. I'll tell you why. I know the answer, of course. Ferromagnetic transition is an SU...
Is a... Is a...
Okay. Okay. I will give you an answer. The regular ferromagnetic transition is a spontaneous breaking of SU2 symmetry. Okay? In this problem, we don't have SU2 symmetry to start with. We have U1 symmetry. Okay? Because the interaction between the two spin species is different. Okay? So, there is this. Now, I mean, the thing is that, why does it happen? You should have asked me a different question. Why doesn't this happen exactly here? Why does it happen at a higher, at a higher value of RS? The reason it happens higher value at RS is that when all the electrons jump from this to that, I'm not going to write down formulas, it's going to take too long, you pay cost in energy. You have to pay the capacitor energy or the Hartree energy. See, the electrons in two layers is what electrostatics wants. Electrostatics doesn't want all the electrons to jump to one layer. That costs a lot of Hartree energy. But eventually, exchange will overcome Hartree because of the power laws are different. And that's why it's at a higher density. If you didn't have Hartree, then it would be exactly the same spot. Okay? Now you think of this, the difference between SU2 and U1. Why should it polarize? This corresponds to polarization. Let me call this sigma z pseudo spin polarized. Okay? Let me call this sigma z pseudo spin polarized. What I mean by that is this is sigma z is equal to plus 1 and this is sigma z is equal to minus 1. Okay? And when all the electrons go there, it's now sigma z is plus 1 or sigma z is minus 1. Okay, sigma z is polarized. Well, the system will have this transition, but why should it polarize sigma z? It costs Hartree energy. It will polarize sigma x. The sigma x polarization will minimize exchange almost as well, not quite. The difference is small though. So it will have a transition, but the transition will be, this costs a lot of Hartree energy because this. So what it will do, it will just rotate and it will go to sigma x polarized state.
So sigma x means what now?
Ah. Right. Sigma x now means, what is sigma x polarized state? Sigma
x. That I do agree with you.
Right. Of course you turned it around. Sigma x polarization is this thing. It's just standard Pauli algebra. Sigma x polarization is this. So it's now an intuitively strange situation. You started with zero tunneling, manifestly zero tunneling, no tunneling in the problem at all. T is still zero. But spontaneous breaking of symmetry will make it feel like there is tunneling. The electrons in the two layers, and this Indiana group named it, or maybe even named before, maybe by Tony Z and Wen and others, I do not know who originally named this, is called interlayer phase coherence. Okay, this thing has a big name.
I always thought that the superposition of things that do not make cannot be physically important.
This is not physically important, but it's theory. that's the next thing I'll do. But there are many papers on it, okay? Many, written by many people in this room, okay? No, I know. Well, at least Shankar agreed with me. No, the point is that let's just talk about the mathematics. I'll come to it. Mathematically, do you agree that this is what is going to happen? You will have a breaking of U1 symmetry. This is exactly what happens. And you will, instead of going to sigma z polarized state, you will go to sigma x polarized state. And the system would look like it has spontaneously generated an interlayer tunneling matrix element. I mean, this happens in BCS all the time, right? I mean, you do not have some matrix elements and anomalous diagrams give rise to those. Exactly the same thing is happening here. And in fact, this was a big subject all the way to the papers written by the Indiana group, where when I read this paper, it seems that there is an underlying implication that high magnetic field is necessary for this physics. What I'm telling you, that's completely unnecessary. It may or may not happen because you have to go to, you know, but people are talking about Wigner crystal. It sure will happen before Wigner crystal. Now, we proved a theorem recently where it showed that within Hartree-Fock theory, what I'm telling you is exact. Okay, that means within Hartree-Fock theory, you'll never have the sigma z polarization, you'll always have the sigma x polarization. It still is open what would happen once you go beyond Hartree-Fock, but the physics is so simple that I think you'll have this interlayer phase coherent state here also.
Sorry, you did Hartree-Fock with U1.
Hartree-Fock with U1 symmetry, absolutely, yes. Yes, because Hartree-Fock is all we can do analytically, and the numerical work here is non-trivial. You have to do this fixed node. In fact, it's so non-trivial that nobody wants to do it because it's a non-local theory. So you have to take into account the exchange between the two layers. And so you need some idea about how you do your fixed mode Monte Carlo. It's not something that you can just take a program and do. So nobody wants to do it. You need some idea about what the wave function should look like. But the physics is reasonably clear to me that I think that just as here the critical RS changes from 2 to 30, there the critical RS will change from 3. That's what it is. This number is 3 within Hartree-Fock, by the way. Only 3, okay? This number will change from 3 to 33 or something. Yeah, it will change. But it will be there. I don't see why it will disappear, since the basic physics is exchange needs to be minimized. And by doing, all you are doing by having sigma x polarization is that you are saying, I'm minimizing exchange almost as well, but I'm not paying as high a price in hot energy. That's the physics. Physics is very clear to me.
You shift to 41 now.
Yes, if you shift to 41, it's not going to happen. Right. This is, you know, that's... But, I mean, I'm talking about the basic physics. Now, this problem, I mean, I realized it recently, really, over the last weekend, that this problem has been studied enormously by various people, at least two of whom are sitting in this room, Tony Z and Steve Garvin. The same thing happens at nu is equal to 1 quantum Hall effect. So I'm going to talk about that for a few minutes, and then we are done.
I'm just trying to learn the jargon here.
Yes.
Because you keep switching between hot energy and hot fog energy when you're speaking really fast.
No, no. I have not given you hot energy at all. No, hold on. No, no. Okay. Let's go slowly.
Yes.
I have not used hot energy at all. I have not. There is no hot energy anywhere. I did not write down a formula. Right. So let me. Right. I said that I did not write down a formula. Okay. Let me. Because that's exactly the case. Okay. Here, when the electrons are in both the layers and the layer densities are equal, by definition, Hartree energy is zero. Hartree energy is zero by definition.
When they're in two different layers.
And equal density. Hartree energy just means the energy associated with inhomogeneous electron density, just the electrostatic energy. Okay.
Hartree energy means the first term?
No. In a uniform electron gas, mm-hmm. by definition, Hartree energy is zero, mm-hmm. because Hartree energy, or it's infinite, mm-hmm. because Hartree energy is exactly cancelled by the background. This is a tadpole diagram. Okay, exactly cancelled, okay? So in a uniform system, you have no Hartree energy.
Good.
So here, when the two layers are equally occupied, that corresponds to the uniform system.
Good.
Okay? There's no Hartree energy. When I put all of them in one, you have a Hartree energy. That's the only case where you have a Hartree energy. I did not write down the formula. Since you asked, let me write down. It's just the capacitor energy, okay? So it's indeed true I did not use the word Hartree anywhere except here, because this is the only case where the Hartree energy arose, okay? So it's not because of speaking fast. It's because that's the only case where it arose. So let me write down. Now, you asked a good question. So let me write down. So let me write down the variational energy for this problem, okay? So let's write our variational state as some xi, which is alpha times left plus minus beta times right. So what I want to do is use this variational state and minimize my Hartree-Fock, my total energy, in which Hartree and Hartree-Fock both will be included, okay? And when I do that, I thought I brought that, what you find, so this is very much like a BCS calculation now for this state, okay? And these are, you can think of these are the Bogoliubov coefficients, basically. And in the end, I'll minimize it. In the picture that I had, where I was saying all the electrons are going in here, I was saying this alpha and beta are 1 or 0. That's the only allowed possibility. I now want to allow more general possibilities. Alpha and beta could be anything. Notice, phase is not important. Everything's real here. So, that alpha squared plus beta squared is 1. So let me write down the Hartree-Fock energy. And the Hartree-Fock energy as a function of this alpha and beta, it can be, the Hartree-Fock theory can be analytically carried out. It's 4 over R squared plus 2d, d is the separation, times alpha square minus beta square, a r square, where a is the Bohr radius, so a dimensionalizes everything.
Gotcha.
Yes.
So you're saying mixing left and right is like mixing different charge states.
Yes.
In the two cases, they're not allowed by the Hamiltonian.
That's correct. So Hamiltonian would not commute. Okay. So you'll have a lot of quantum fluctuations, but the symmetry breaking still would take place. And the whole thing is multiplied by energy. I'm going to put the right energies also. Times a squared over ab. Well, let me just make that dimensional. Yes. And where, now this thing, I drs is an integral, which is this non-local exchange energy, which is 4 times Bohr radius divided by d pi times, and I'm going to explain each term, dx integral 0 to 1, dx x integral 0 to pi d theta, and then you'll have this exponential coming in, e to the power 2 square root of 2 d over Bohr radius rs times 1 over 1 minus x squared sine squared theta minus x cosine theta. Okay? And this integral is, you know, not a standard integral. And so each term here, you can see what they are. This is just your kinetic energy. This is the Hartree energy, okay? Right? This is the Hartree energy. It's proportional to D, as it should be. It's just a capacitive energy, okay? It's just a capacitive energy, all right? And if you take alpha and beta to be 1 and 0, this energy is maximum, as it should be, okay? So what now happens, and this is the exchange energy, this last term.
Alpha squared minus beta squared?
That's correct. That's what happens. Well, it doesn't matter. It's real. I told you.
Sorry,
so.
But it flips on.
No, that's just because you made a specific choice on which one you're calling xi1, which one you're calling xi2. You can take beta squared. Okay, that's irrelevant. Why don't I write down the value that minimizes it, which will make you feel much better then. Okay. this value minimizes it. Okay, which is exactly what you'd expect. This is what you would expect. And you can actually calculate. Remember, this exchange energy is still not trivial. You have to calculate the exchange energy and show this is not exactly the same as what you would have when you sigma z polarizes. The exchange energy is lower slightly. Your gain in exchange energy is slightly less than before, okay, than sigma z polarization. But your gain in here is huge because it's a very large number. So when you minimize it, this is the value that minimizes it, okay?
Excuse me.
Yes.
So you're not worried by the fact that beta equal to 1 is a different energy from alpha equal to 1?
This I made a specific choice. This is the way things are going. It's if you change it, it's a question of which one I'm calling plus, which one I'm calling minus. There is no problem here. Believe me, there is no problem whatsoever. Okay, we can discuss, but there is no problem. Okay, because
no.
The thing is that you don't really know. You don't really know. I don't know why you are making the statement. Hold on. Just by looking at it, how do you know that beta is equal to 1 and alpha is equal to 1 have different values?
I look at your wave function.
Yes.
Tilt it all towards alpha.
Yes.
Or all towards beta, it should cause the same energy. That's not true. If it's purely on the left and purely on the right.
Absolutely.
Value sign,
yeah, there is an absolute value sign. Which one is bothering?
Alpha squared minus beta squared.
Yes. This one. Okay, I understand now. I was completely confused. Sorry. Absolutely. I'm sorry. I didn't even see what you're talking about. Sorry. You're absolutely right. Dan, you are right too. I didn't follow the point. Absolutely. It's alpha square minus beta square. Okay? All right, so this is the answer. So the question now is that what is this state, and is this state physical or not? Okay. So Shankar said this state is not physical, and I kind of facetiously agreed with you. What I said is, I think the state is very physical. I think the question is, does the state exist or not, for reasons Eduardo was asking me. I think if this state is as physical as a ferromagnetic state. I don't know why you said that this state is not physical. Do you agree that a ferromagnetic state is physical?
Well, the question is, can you get to this?
Right, that's a different question, but that's, I don't think, you didn't mean that. You said that if you don't...
No. All I was saying, a general principle, quantum mechanics.
Right.
You've got two wells with an infinite barrier between them. Forming symmetric and acting accommodations has no meaning. That's all I was saying.
Well, the state exists.
I'm saying, I'm...
In our world, we're born agents.
I think you're wrong. I think you're wrong on that.
The phase is not detectable.
Right, exactly. Precisely. It's very much like you cannot talk about number. You have an expectation value of the number density. It's not a sharp variable. Expectation value will say it's equal, but it's fluctuating a lot. And there's no problem with that. This is exactly what happens in superconducting condensate. I mean, it has nothing to do with, I mean, it's a true symmetry breaking. It's a true symmetry breaking. You know, now whether you can reach to it or not is a different question. I'm much more concerned about where this number is, okay? And the second problem is, and which to me is even worse, even if you reach there, how do you know this state is there? I have not been able to come up with any way of distinguishing this phase from a regular tunneling phase. I mean, how do we distinguish this phase from just T not equal to zero phase? Okay? This is my problem. Meaning, I got very excited. In fact, in our paper, we say there should be a Goldstone mode because you are breaking E1 symmetry. Okay, you're breaking E1 symmetry, and there will be a Goldstone mode. And in fact, in this room, at least two people are sitting down. Over the weekend, I found out they calculated the dispersion of this Goldstone mode. Well, dispersion of this Goldstone mode, since you're breaking E1 symmetry, is there is a Goldstone mode here, and the Goldstone mode for this problem goes linear in Q. Okay? I already told you that in this system, you have a linear in Q mode if there is no tunneling to start with. How are you going to distinguish the Goldstone mode from that? I just told you that the acoustic plasmon in this, if you have no tunneling, is linear in Q.
tunneling break that you want symmetry, isn't it?
That's correct. But if you have tunneling, then there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking anyway. If there is tunneling, you have a magnetic field. If you have tunneling, then you are talking about ferromagnetism in the presence of magnetic field. So I'm talking about T is equal to zero everywhere. What I'm asking this, be careful what I'm saying. What I'm saying, how do you distinguish this state? So the question I'm asking, and this is the question that is bothering me the most, because having the phase, so you have a T not equal to zero possibility, okay? And the other possibility is T is equal to zero, but you have this coherent phase, okay? Okay, these are the two possibilities I want to distinguish, okay? My question is, how do I experimentally distinguish between these two phases? I have two different systems. One system I have finite tunneling, and the other system, by magic I know tunneling is zero, but I also know that coherent phase. Let's I tell you these two things. Now you have to tell me how you'd convince somebody else through an experiment that there is this dichotomy.
T not equal to zero, you lost V1 symmetry.
Right. I lost V1 symmetry. Absolutely. Right.
So theoretically you would get
no, I that's really kind. Sorry. T is equal to zero. T is equal to zero and RS is below RC. Okay? Okay, how do you distinguish between the two? Because you measure density, nobody measures the density eigenvalue. You measure, all experiments measure density expectation value. Density expectation value will give you exactly the same number. Okay? It will give half there, up there. You measure Goldstone mode. That's how the proposal is. I already told you Goldstone mode, there is a Goldstone mode here, but there is an acoustic plasmon there. I already told you that. Acoustic plasmon has exactly linearity. I said something wrong here. I meant T is equal to zero, okay? So only experiment I could think of is take the suggestion of superfluidity very seriously and Josephson effect, which would be easier to do here if the effect exists, but the problem is disorder, of course, will play havoc with it. Now, let me just throw you some buzzwords now, since most of us are theorists. This system now, after the U1 symmetry is broken, it's a very interesting system because it's what is called an easy plane ferromagnet. It's essentially the same as an XY model. It will have Costa-Lefkowitz transition. It will have Josephson effect. It will have all those things. Only thing is that I can't think of any experiment which can see it. There are two proposed experiments for high field. Two. One with the claim it has been seen. First proposed experiment is, I think, Wen and Z and Ezawa, and that is some variant of Josephson effect. The idea is that you have this density fluctuation between the layer. If you look at N1 minus N2, and this was already discussed, so you'll have a Josephson effect which will go as J is proportional to sine EVT divided by H bar for exactly the same argument as Josephson original argument, except 2E is replaced by E here because you don't have, it's not a superconducting condensate, it's more like an exciton condensate, it's more like a Bose-Einstein condensation of excitons, you know, electron here, electron in this layer and hole in that layer, but they're tied together and that's condensing, but the properties are the same as a superconducting condensate. So you should be able to see that. In a high magnetic field is an impossible experiment. Here also I don't think it's an easy experiment, nobody has seen it. The other is a very complicated explanation in a parallel magnetic field. This should lead to various physics, which is what I was trying to learn from these papers. But I think Steve will not disagree with me if I say it's a very complicated explanation of the experiment. I mean, is that correct? I mean, well, anyway, that's it's a Shina Murphy experiment. I mean, you claim this has been seen. You claim in a paper this has been seen in, well, three or four papers. This has been seen in this Shina Murphy experiment where, I mean, since I'm alluding to it, let me tell you what they see. So let me just now do the last thing. What the same physics should happen at nu is equal to one quantum Hall effect now. Exactly the same physics. Oh, by the way, I told you that I'll tell you meirons. If this phase exists, then even at B is equal to zero, you will have vortex-like structures, you know, soliton excitations in connecting this, see, zero-field meirons, okay? Zero-field meirons are more likely than Wigner crystal, is what I'm telling you, okay? It will happen before Wigner crystallization, I think, but I cannot prove, okay? But let me just tell you what happens at nu is equal to 1, quantum Hall effect. And to do that, let me just draw the phase diagram, experimental phase diagram right away. Excuse me? Yes. So let me just talk about delta SAS. So I'm drawing actually.
It's a vortex.
But the vortexes are connected. There are two vortex. One here, vortex here, one anti-vortex there, right?
Yeah.
They're connected. I mean, so D over L, LB. D over LB. So this is the phase diagram I'm drawing. Nu is equal to 1 quantum Hall effect. Again, you have a double layer system. Everything the same, double layer system, except now you have very high magnetic field. So very high magnetic field, all the exchange physics comes in. So having this very high magnetic field is equivalent to having RS very large. That's in principle what you're achieving. And this is a known phase diagram experimentally. What you find is, this is around 2. And this is around 0.04. Okay? What you find is that you have no quantum Hall effect here. That means you don't see any plateau. And you see quantum Hall effect here for nu is equal to 1. Okay? This is experimentally verified. So let's just go through it slightly carefully. Okay? What do you expect in a double layer system? Now, spin is not a relevant variable now. Electromagnetic field is so high that spin dynamics is frozen out. Okay? So what you expect if nu is just 1, nu half on each layer. Normally you don't expect any quantum Hall effect. But now suppose you have strong tunneling, or you have any tunneling, let's say. If you have any tunneling, then there is a tunneling gap, this symmetric and asymmetric gap. So then you say for any finite tunneling, you should have quantum Hall effect. And for zero tunneling, you should not have quantum Hall effect. Because for zero tunneling, this gap collapses to zero. There's a single particle picture. Experimentally, both of these facts turn out to be wrong. You have a quantum Hall effect at zero tunneling. Look at that. This whole region, T is equal to zero, and I think it's experimentally reasonably well verified that there is a quantum Hall effect, although actual experimental point on this line doesn't exist to my satisfaction, but it's very close. All the experimentalists I talk to, which means Shagan and Eisenstein, just about the best, tell me that they are convinced the points will come all the way to this line. So let's accept it as a fact that even for zero tunneling, you have a quantum Hall effect in these systems. This is only possible if you are in that phase. So this is this coherent phase, which in a high magnetic field becomes more possible in some sense, okay? And that's why all the studies on this before were in this high magnetic field, okay? And implications are it cannot happen, even though it was not stated, but it can happen equally in low magnetic field, zero magnetic field. So first, you have a quantum Hall effect with zero tunneling. Second, if I take a single particle picture, this is what the phase diagram would look like, right? D divided by delta SS, it will say, no tunneling along this line, and no quantum Hall effect on this line, quantum Hall effect everywhere else. Let me just tell you what the simple theory says, okay? Simple theory says along this line you have no quantum Hall effect, and you have quantum Hall effect everywhere else, because, you know, there may be some temperature window, you may have to go to slightly higher temperature. But basically what happens first, both parts are wrong. Here you have a quantum Hall effect, and once you go there, it seems quantum Hall effect is destroyed once you go above some D. Both of these are experimentally well verified, okay? So you have two problems. One is that you have a quantum Hall effect at T is equal to zero, and I kind of resolved it by saying, well, if you have interlayer phase coherence, then of course a gap would open up just because of breaking up this U1 symmetry. So this is like, we believe that the electron, single layer electron system is spin polarized even if G is zero. We heard a lot of talks on that just by exchange effect. Same physics here. On the other hand, this I didn't tell you anything about. This is saying that when you go to finite D, the effect is destroyed here. So that basically says that over here, the effect should be destroyed somewhere, and that's just quantum fluctuation effect, which are very hard to calculate in this. No, finite D, the separation. You can see that here, if you take some finite tunneling, your basic intuition would say you should have quantum Hall effect everywhere. It should not depend on how far the layers are separated. If you have finite tunneling, you have symmetric anti-symmetric gap. There may be a question of resolution, whether you can see it or not, because of temperature broadening and so on. But that should be like a diffusing here. But this is a very well-defined thing. So somehow this U1 symmetry broken phase is disappearing in this whole region where it should be something more than that, even if it's a single particle delta SS that's being suppressed. And this is subject of another talk. We understand it for the quantum Hall problem. Essentially what is happening, the system is going into some other phase due to a phase transition whose nature we do not understand. It's actually one of the outstanding unsolved theoretical problems. You take the two layers, you make them very far apart, you go all the way up here, we believe there should be no quantum Hall effect, even if there is finite tunneling, because it would be two HLR liquids, two Halperin-Lee-Reed liquid. Okay, that's what you expect all the way up there. That's, I think, we all agree, okay? Even though there is no theory showing the transition, but intuitively we expect that will overcome delta SAS. But what about here, very close to it? Most likely very close to it is a charge density wave state. And in fact, theoretical work by Hart-Fertig and later by others kind of indicate that you have a mode softening at finite Q which depends on D, and you can track this line. Alan MacDonald did a digital calculation. You can track this line. So probably around here, very close to it, but just above, is some kind of charge density wave state. And then over there, it's going into an HLF state. It's a fascinating problem, which I think in high magnetic field, one can actually explore somehow. Because there are lots of papers. You can do Hartree-Fock theory is very good, kind of theory that Catherine Kallin and Bart Halperin started. It's very good around here. And Bart did Hart did that and found that a mode goes soft for these values of D, which basically means that this state is not stable. On the other hand, how to go from here to there, we do not know. And in some sense, this is an important problem because we heard a lot in this program, our program already, that there is something about half states we do not understand. Eisenstein's experiment indicating charge density wave state, but we know at nu is equal to half, the state is more like HLR. This is a double layer aspect of it, understanding it. But I still don't know what happens in my B is equal to zero situation.
Yes. Delta SIS equals zero.
Yes.
I can see that we can distinguish between the coherent and incoherent state
right.
by whether there's a four plateau, I guess.
Right. Right, that's exactly what it is. It's an experimental plot.
How are you distinguishing?
That's, I cannot. That's what I said. In zero, that's what I said. The problem is, in finite field, one whole plateau gives you a clue. That's, I still do not know how to distinguish the two. I mean, I would like some idea on that, experimentally, how to distinguish it at B is equal to zero if they exist. And I, other than Josephson effect, which will still be there. All right, I'm going to stop here.
Does that
Thanks.
Formula give you some hint on what happens at Bosch D? Does that give you
No, this doesn't have quantum fluctuation. This is Hartree-Fock. This is pure mean field.
Oh, okay.
So somehow what I have to do is to systematically include quantum fluctuations over this mean field. So it's very much like going beyond DCS, you know, which quantum fluctuations here are important. And it's something I'm not working on. I'm not going to work on it until I have an answer to this question, because if it cannot be experimentally seen, well, I'm then not that interested. All right, thank you very much for your attention, and I took more than what I should. And almost everything I talked about, you know, has several papers underlying it, and if anybody wants to discuss it, please come, because I have not read the Indiana papers. I can explain almost everything.